I'm Martin Reeves, Chairman of the Beeshe Henderson Institute. Welcome to our Thinkers and Ideas podcast, where we discuss important new books and ideas for business. And joining me today is Gert Kigerenzer. He's been on the program before talking about his books. And to remind you, although no reminder is necessary in his case, I think, he's a psychologist who spent 50 years or so studying bounded rationality, heuristics, decision-making and the like. He is director of the Harding Center of Risk Literacy at the University of Potsdam. He is an emeritus director of the Max Planck Institute in Germany. And he is a theoretician, but also he's a practitioner in the sense that he trains judges, physicians, managers on decision making. And today he's talking about his new book with us, The Intelligence of Intuition, which came out towards the end of last year, in which he makes the case that our emphasis on logical rationality and more recently on algorithms and AI may be a little unbalanced and that intuition doesn't get as much emphasis as it should. So I'm looking forward to discussing that with you, Gert, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here again.
So I think your book seems to make, and I hope I don't mischaracterize this, the case that we sort of over-rely in modern times on what you might call logical rationality, and we sort of regard as inferior in some way the intelligence of intuition, which is a different type of intelligence. So before we dive into the details, could you help maybe to define loosely those two ways of thinking?
Yeah. So logical rationality is the idea that by using logic, the laws of logic, the calculus of probability, and the maximization of expected utility, you will be able to solve all problems. So that's the vision. It's a universalist approach. That has never worked. Logic is a good tool for some problems, but not for all. A simple demonstration is, if I say, this evening I invited friends and colleagues, the end does not have the logical meaning because I didn't mean the intersection, and you understand that, but all of them who are either friends or colleagues or both. So that illustrates, in other cases, I mean with end the intersection. Yeah. So in order to get this job, you need to be smart and critical. I mean both. So human intelligence infers these meanings, and it's much smarter than the application of logic.
So if that's one end of the spectrum, the application of the laws of logic, tell us what intuition is. How does intuition differ?
So intuition is a form of unconscious intelligence that is based on, first, years of experience. Second, it tells you, so the intuitive idea is quickly in your consciousness. You know what to do and not. And third, we cannot explain our intuitions. So intuition is not a sixth sense or God's idea or what some arbitrary or an arbitrary judgment of some political leader. It is also not what only women have. Everyone can have intuition. So that's what I mean. And you get to intuition in two ways. One is you learn something by rules explicit, and then it goes into the unconscious. So like playing piano, you learn where you put your fingers and the timing, but music only starts when you do not know anymore what your fingers is doing. And there's a second way. You never learn something explicit, but by looking. So in many professions, the experts learn by looking at something, often having an experienced colleague who points to them. Do you see that there? And at the beginning, you don't see anything. Then you start to see. So these are two different ways to learn intuition.
Now, your work has a lot to do with heuristics, and you mentioned the word heuristics a lot in your book. What is the connection between heuristics and intuition? Are heuristics the unconscious, implicit programs which inform intuition, or is heuristics something else?
A heuristic is a rule of thumb. Yeah? It is the art to concentrate on the important and ignore the rest. And heuristics can be social, like imitation, which happens often in businesses. They copy other businesses. It can be more individual. You just focus on the one important point, and that's your judgment. And heuristics can be used consciously or unconsciously. The unconscious use is intuition.
Right. But the fact that they can also be conscious, deliberate, choiceful, is that the connection between choiceful application of intuition and unconscious or silent application of intuition?
For instance, a baseball outfielder catches a ball by an entire bundle of heuristics. The person doesn't compute the trajectory. That's almost impossible in that time. And the problem is not computation, but estimation of all the parameters. So if one of these heuristics is the gaze heuristic, that works if the ball is already high up in the air, and it consists of three steps. Focus your eye on the ball, start running, and adjust your running speed so that the angle of gaze remains constant. And you can see you will end up there where the ball is coming down. Baseball outfielders use that mostly unconscious. They cannot tell you how they do what they do, but you can make this explicit and teach them. And also, yeah, pilots are taught this rule.
Right. So a large part of the first part of your book deals with why we've come to neglect or somehow deprecate this ability of intuition. I think the ancient philosophers would have thought that intuition was something to celebrate. Is this not Aristotle's so-called direct knowledge? And how did we come to look down on intuition?
Yeah, that's a very interesting process. So to make it short, in the past, intuition was attributed to angels and heavenly beings who had no body and no sensory organs and therefore could intuit the truth immediately without our eyes and ears who deceive us. Then, during the Enlightenment, it started that intuition was considered as something suspicious. And finally, it ended up to be attributed to women. It's female intuition versus male reason, which there was no evidence for that, but it just brought the two second placed, so intuition below reason and women below men at that time, yeah, together. And that story kept on going, and intuition was something suspicious, not to be trusted, and at least in the social sciences, not so much in the natural sciences. Einstein said very clearly, intuition is a gift, and reason is its servant. And we have created a society that celebrates the servant and has forgotten the gift.
Yes, that's clear. So let's talk about those situations then where intuition may actually be more powerful than logical reasoning. And you give three important words, I think, in your book. You say that situations that involve problems that are very intractable or incomputable, a situation which involve incommensurability, you can't easily quantify what you're talking about. And you also talk about uncertainty, where we don't really know the single end state of the system. So why is intuition particularly powerful when those elements are present?
So in the classical view of decision that is prominent in neoclassical economics and in many social fields and also in part of behavioral economics, there is a calculus of expected utility maximization that can be applied to everything, so the claim is. And in order to apply an optimization calculus to everything, you need to exclude uncertainty, that is where you don't know the state space, what can happen. You need to exclude all problems that are not tractable, as you mentioned. Chess, for instance, you can't calculate the best option in chess. And you need to exclude all problems where there's incommensurability. What is that? So incommensurability means that you cannot bring two issues. You really can't compare them, and you cannot trade off one of these. Herbert Simon famously choked that he is insured precisely to the degree at which his family is indifferent between him living and dying. So that's an example about incommensurability. So there are things which cannot trade it off for money. And heuristics and intuition can deal with all of those everyday situations.
So I wondered, reading a book, whether you're talking about an ageless problem, a perennial problem, or something which is particularly relevant now. So most business textbooks, in their first chapter, they begin by saying the world is more complicated and fast-moving than it has ever been before, in which case this would be a good argument for emphasizing intuition. Do you personally believe that the world has these three qualities more and more, and therefore there is a stronger and stronger case for intuition, or is this something which is universal and timeless?
Yeah, this statement, you can find it a century ago and another century ago. Everyone thinks that everything is going faster and faster. And some things are going faster, others not. And what we have at the moment is a revolution in algorithms, in AI. Certainly, there are fast movements, but that doesn't mean that AI can solve all problems, as some people tell us, or it will, together with AI, become a homo deus, some like godlike being, as Yuval Harari is fantasizing. So I also hear the old dreams of humanity becoming immortal are coming back and are projected in the new technology. And yes, we are in a VUCA world, so that's what I'm calling uncertainty. And we need intuition, we need intelligence, and we need data. The big error is to bet only on one side. We will always need both.
And I guess that's a natural segue to a wonderful idea in your book, which I wasn't familiar with, which is Simon's scissors analogy. Tell us about the scissors analogy, which I took to mean the match between a problem and the tools that you apply to the problem.
Right. Herbert Simon made the famous point that in order to understand behavior, you need to look at both cognition and the environment. That sounds trivial, but there are many disciplines who just look at one blade of the scissors. So a behaviorist look at the environment, B.F. Skinner. Most economists look at incentive structures, the environment, and don't want to have anything to do with psychology. Many psychologists make the opposite error. They only look into the mind, and then they talk about being risk-averse, or having loss aversion, without thinking how well some of these principles or heuristics would work in the real world. And the real challenge is a different one, to identify the heuristics people use in business, in everyday life, and see what are the conditions where they work and where don't they work. This is the big challenge, and it's often hard to get this idea into people's mind. For instance, the mainstream behavioral economics is based on only looking at the cognitive plate. So there are terms like availability and representativeness, and then there are system one and system two. These are all here. And the question, when would some of these heuristics work and when not, is not even posed.
Just to draw out a couple of those connections, you talk about bias, which is an interesting idea. You say basically, a bias is our, if you like, our evolved instinct in relation to a problem. And this is treated by behavioral economics or science more or less as a problem. You point out that the references pointing out to these heuristics, if you will, as problems is more voluminous than those pointing it out as a solution. And that in turn begs the idea of the right tool, as you've said, in the right circumstances. So tell us a little bit about your thinking on biases and your thinking on how to construct this toolkit of different cognitive tools for different types of problem.
So I have written this article that you mentioned, the bias in behavioral economics. And I myself see myself as a part of doing behavioral economics. But the problem is there's one stream of behavioral economics who uses logical rationality as the standard for every behavior, and then makes problems where content is filled in, mostly textbook problems. And if people use their intelligence and make judgments, and it differs from logic rationality, the blame is always on the people and never on the theory. Well, that's what I'm rejecting here. And the bias is related to that. It's the tendency to see biases everywhere, even if there are none, or only unsystematic error. So a bias is defined as a systematic error. And we have too many of these. And the key problem is, it's not that people make no errors, no. But you need to evaluate them against the success in the environment and not against a logical rule. That's the key problem here.
So let's move on to applying your ideas and particularly applying them in business. So if one said, yeah, this makes sense, we should use our intuition in the complex, dynamic, unquantifiable problems of business, how would you go about systematically or intentionally or effectively applying your thoughts on intuition? Because there's a little problem here, isn't there, which is that the intuition is often invisible. So how can we use intuition choicefully?
Yeah. So I can give you a few examples. So one is, and I derived them from the definition of intuition. So intuition is based on long years of experience. That's one part. The longer you've experienced with a topic, the better your intuitions likely are. A beginner has no good intuitions. So in many businesses, the incoming leaders are rotated around. So you spend a few months here, a few months here, and forever. This is a situation where these young people get an overview, but no good intuitions. In order to have good intuitions, you need to have them longer time. That's a very simple consequence of that. The second part of the definition of intuition is that you can't explain it, and one has to respect this. Example, I once worked with a company, and they had four executives in their top leadership, and they told me the following story. They were thinking about a fusion, so about a big thing, and they were thinking into the night, and it was early in the morning, and then three of them thought, let's do it. And one had a bad feeling. So the three asked one person, explain your negative gut feeling. And the good guy tried to come up with reasons, and the other three destroyed the reasons, and they sailed into misfortune. The lesson here is, if there is a person that has an intuition, it makes no sense to ask that person, explain, because you will only invent some reason after the fact.
Right. But that's a very interesting problem, Gert, isn't it? Because, so in this particular case example, the unexplainable intuition turned out to be correct. And one might even say that it was bound to be correct because it was based on long experience. On the other hand, from the point of view of the other two people in the situation, faith in something which is invisible may sometimes be a good thing, may sometimes be a bad thing. So I guess I'd call this a problem of taming, which is there's some sort of productive force here, but how do we tame it enough to use it?
Yeah. So Martin, what this group ended up to understand is, as I said, there's no point to explain. But there's another question that the other three should ask themselves. Is he who has this bad feeling the one who has most experience with this type of problem? If yes, no questions asked. Then we find a different investment. So one should not think that intuition is always right. No. But it's better, often better, in particular if a person is experienced, than other types of decision making.
Mm-hmm. In a way, as I read your book, this was the burning question for me. Namely, you know, I was fairly quickly convinced of your argument that this approach of intuition through explicit or implicit heuristics can be very powerful. But I constantly find myself asking, how would I distinguish a charlatan or the wrong intuition from the right intuition? And I thought actually towards the end of your book, you sort of answered this question when you gave the example of how you manage your lab in Potsdam. So you had a number of operational practices, to use a piece of business jargon, where you did things to encourage the cultivation of intuition. Could you tell us your philosophy of running your Potsdam lab?
Yeah. So it was actually my lab at the Max Planck Institute for Human Development in Berlin. And I was director for over 20 years there. And before I was at the University of Chicago, and when I left for Max Planck, I thought about how to set up an interdisciplinary group that actually works together, rather than being on paper interdisciplinary, and in order to create innovation. So some of the rules I set is, first, hire people at the same time that caused lots of problems for the institute, for the administration, but it is very important to avoid situations where some who are out there longer feel that they are the big brothers of the newcomers. So have them at the same time, and then they have to struggle together with all the new things, even with the administration, that forms a form of community. Second, we have everyone on the same level, same space, so on the same floor, which is very important because otherwise the interaction goes down by 50%. For instance, when my group kept expanding and the group was then about 30 researchers, including from graduate students to what would be in the US system, assistant professors and tenured professors. And the architect proposed building a new building in the premises. I said, no, that would destroy my research, having half of the group here and half of the group there. No, I said, we will extend the present building horizontally. So to keep everyone on the same floor. So these are examples. That's not always possible, but it's very important. Another rule is have tea and coffee every day at 4 o'clock. That's not a waste of time, this a half an hour or hour. But people get together and they may talk about personal things. That shapes trust and the willingness to expose their own ignorance, to say, I never understood it. Can you explain it? And also, it creates new ideas, and people from different disciplines learn that they can actually learn from the others. So these are some of the rules that are implemented. And then when a group is successful and running over time, you have to change some of these rules. It's no longer good to hire new people all at the same time. That would destroy the culture. The culture is going on, handed on from one to another one. And a most important point is an open culture. Not only doors open, but everyone can criticize the idea of everyone, including my ideas as the director. And nobody is punished. Everyone is encouraged. But it needs to be a respectful type of critique, but an open one. So these are some of the rules that I implemented.
Yes. I think there are a lot of lessons there. So I try to rationalize the connection between the theory in the early part of your book and the practices in your lab. And I'd like your sort of evaluation of my interpretation. So my interpretation is that, in a sense, you were trying to create an environment where experience was accumulated, common heuristics developed, and there was some sort of pressure to select effective heuristics because people had shared experience. So in a sense, you were saying, shape the environment that shapes the heuristics, and shared heuristics equals culture. Would that be a good way of thinking about what you did?
It is a scissors type of thinking. Set up an environment where people can have the courage to discuss openly rather than defensively, as in many businesses. And also, they can trust the other ones. And without trust, you have little chance for innovation because people will protect and hide themselves. By setting up one blade of the scissors, that allows the entire system to cut.
That's a great way of thinking about culture, I think, Gerd, because often culture is defined in a very nebulous way, but the environment that shapes a common set of effective heuristics, both the sharing and the selecting, I think is an interesting way of thinking about culture.
Yeah, and it's very concrete. That's the advantage, rather than saying you need a good culture or an open culture. So the heuristics create the culture. For instance, here's something that I always found very important. So I had the big fear when I left the University of Chicago that ending up as a director of a Max Planck Institute, I would be up there like a god, and nobody would dare to criticize my ideas, and I would never learn. And that had happened to many others, not only in science, but think about Putin, who seems to suffer from having no contrarian. Nobody who tells him the truth. So, always hired at least one person whom I knew he or she would be a contrarian, who would not be willing to go with the group thinking, and also would not hesitate to criticize my own ideas. But it must be on a factual and respectful way. And that is very important. I can only advise every leader, the higher up you is, the more you need contrarians.
Right. I'll apply for that job, Gerd, if that job becomes open. So unfortunately, it's a very rich topic, but our time is limited. Let me just ask you about one more aspect, which is important in your book, I think, which is, as I read it, you're quite cautious about over-relying on AI. And, you know, if I may put the counter-argument to you, if I may be that contrarian for a second, you know, the game of Go is a very intractable problem, even more possibilities than chess, and has not been historically very tractable to computation. But nevertheless, with DeepMind's AlphaGo algorithm, not only was the program able to beat humans, but there were some innovative moves which had never really been seen by the top players before, and they became part of the repertoire of the top players, and they were essentially intuited by the program. So isn't this a situation where AI, in fact, can create a contribution in these intractable, complex spaces? And aren't large language models, in a sense, tools for tapping into our collective intelligence? Or would you view it a different way?
Yeah, you're right. The big successes of AI are in well-defined situations. These are games like chess and Go. These are industry applications. And even if you feed generative AI with all the what you find on the internet, the structure of a language is fairly constant. So the important question is, where can we expect that AI, meaning here deep neural networks, because AI is much broader, that deep neural networks, deep artificial neural networks will succeed, and where they won't? That's the question. One should not become a partisan being an enthusiast or an opponent. There is no method and no AI that can do every problems. That's a fantasy. So the general idea is AI will do well if the problem is well-defined and if it's stable, so that tomorrow is like yesterday. AI will have problems if it has to predict an uncertain future or other things that are fairly unpredictable, like people's behavior, or viruses that mutate all the time. So this is a first distinction. And in my book, How to Stay Smart in a Smart World, that helps people to see where the success can be and where it will be just a marketing hype.
Yes. So I can't resist asking you a personal question, Gerd, because I think we're both amateur musicians, although you perhaps more professionally than myself. So as a jazz musician, I'm sure you're very familiar with improvisation, and I wanted to ask you whether you see any connection between improvisation, creativity, and intuition. Is there some sort of connection there? Because improvisation is a sort of a problem, a very nebulous problem, perhaps an incommensurable problem. What's your own view on the heuristics that you're applying when you improvise?
So improvisation is like almost everything in the world, a mixture between learning, exercise, and intuition. So if you do a gig on a guitar, you have like building blocks. But the moment you play, and I can only tell from my own experience, you don't do it anymore. It just goes. It goes. And the less it's conscious, the better it becomes. But again, it's not something arbitrary. It is an art that develops over years and years of experience.
Well, on that note, we'll probably wrap it up there, Gerd. Thanks so much for spending time with us on your book, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I've been discussing The Intelligence of Intuition, a book by Gerd Gigerenzer, which came out from Cambridge University Press, September 2023. I really enjoyed the book. In a sense, business is problem solving, a strategy is problem solving, and I think the book has many lessons, but the big one for me was the importance of the scissors analogy, namely applying the right approach to problem solving to the right problem and developing that intuition of intuition, that intuition about which method to apply when. And I think the book powerfully touches on three very different types of problem solving: the modeling analytic school of problem solving, which is very, very important in business, the intuition experience-based approach to problem solving, and now this new kid on the block of when and how to use artificial intelligence. And I think that's an important problem for all business leaders to think about. So thanks again, Gerd.
It was a pleasure.
If you like the conversation, make sure you're subscribed on your favorite podcasting platform. And as always, we welcome your feedback to the Beastie Henderson Institute.